Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Dr. Tina Thompson and Dr. Ursula Balthazar of the Alaska Women's Clinic, and our topic is menopause. Dr. Thompson's been around in Anchorage for a while, and she's limited her practice to gynecology since 1992. She did her training at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Dr. Balthazar just joined the Alaska Women's Clinic a year ago. She did all of her postgraduate medical training at Chapel Hill at the University of North Carolina, where she has a degree or a residency in obstetrics and gynecology, but then went on to complete a fellowship in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. So once again, our topic is menopause. You're welcome to call and ask questions and make comments. And to do that, you can reach us at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And over the next hour, we'll be also available by email at line1. You're going to have to write that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at alaskapublic.org. Tina, welcome back. And Dr. Balthazar, nice to see you.
Thank you, Thad. I should make one correction, though. It's the Anchorage Women's Clinic.
I said Alaska. All right, I apologize. Alaska Women's Clinic, or Anchorage Women's Clinic. I've got it written down wrong. That's my biggest problem. Okay.
All righty.
All right, so we're talking about menopause, so let's start with some definitions.
Well, I think probably the most important thing to start with is that menopause is a natural physiologic transition that people go through. It's not some kind of a disease state. And menopause is actually a Greek word that means stopping periods, stopping bleeding. You know, about 100 years ago, when we went through the millennial change, there was a lot of data about, you know, when 1899 rolled into 1900. And apparently back then, women only lived on average to be about 45 years old. So we've probably only really started experiencing menopause in large numbers in the last half of the last century, as we've, you know, started to enjoy our older age, you know, the purported golden years, that kind of thing. So we really are dealing a lot with menopause these days. Most of us anticipate going through menopause, and it's a natural thing. Most women will stop having their periods somewhere between 40s and about 62. The median age in America is 51, but there's a big bell curve, 51 years old. And interestingly, in Wikipedia, they have a that in Australia, it's 51.8. and fascinating to me, they also mention that women from India and the Philippines go through menopause a little earlier, 44. Do you see a preponderance of more premature ovarian failure or more early menopause?
No, I don't think that there is a racial distribution that they've noted. I think because it's so much earlier, because premature menopause is cessation of menses before 40. Mm-hmm. So I think that we haven't necessarily seen a trend in who that's more common, because it's abnormal if it ever occurs before 40.
Right. And it's a large period of time you're talking about.
Cause right.
One of the things I was going to ask is, what about, we know that in certain cultures in particular that puberty starting earlier. Is there a relationship between the onset of puberty and the onset of...
Oh.
Well, that is actually, they commented on that in Up to Date, which I had read just to look at, and they said that it actually didn't matter, mm-hmm. that when menses started wasn't predictive of when menses ended. So as we do see women go through puberty and start periods early, that it's not affecting racially when menopause is starting.
And actually, you know, I would say exactly the same thing. My understanding is that young girls are starting their menstrual cycles earlier, mostly because they're getting large quickly.
Right. Weight-wise.
Almost always weight-related, whereas menopause is often familial. Mm-hmm. You know, if your mother was in her 40s, you'll often be in your 40s. If I have one patient who says her mom didn't quit menstruating until she was well into her 60s, and she was, you know, in her maybe late 50s or so. Mm-hmm.
I want to just detour just a second, because it's always interesting to me about misconceptions. The early puberty issue, so many people think it's related to hormones and milk and soy and so forth. And my understanding is also it's more related to size and weight, mm-hmm. which we're all Western countries, and that's the driving factor, it appears, for early earlier menses, earlier puberty. Is that your understanding also?
We're nodding our heads like crazy over here, right? I've always told people about 110 pounds, somewhere around there. Okay. You know, if your daughter is six when she hits 110, then you know, maybe shortly thereafter.
All right. So back to the other end of the
The other end of the spectrum. All right. I might want to go over a couple of organs just for anybody who's not real familiar with the organ systems we're dealing with. But the uterus is also referred, of course, to as the womb. That's where a pregnancy would implant and carry. That's also where the endometrial lining in the inside of the uterus is what grows and bleeds with the menstrual cycle. So the blood comes from the inside of the uterus. The uterus, though, is not an organ that produces any hormones. It's basically under the influence of the hormones from the ovaries. So even though menopause is a clinical definition, that is when your last period happens, if a woman has her uterus removed but she still has her ovaries, she may still have the hormones that she wants and enjoys but not have the period. That's a surgical menopause in a sense. And then women who have and in fact, we can be a little bit more specific about menopause these days because we can measure some of the hormones from the ovaries. Although, frankly, in the phase that we often refer to as the perimenopause, from when a woman heads towards menopause and before she gets completely beyond it, that can be a really irregular hormonal period, both for irregular cycles, skipping some periods come and may be heavy. But during that whole phase, then the hormones are really a mess to check. And people can spend a lot of time checking their, you know, serum FSH, which is a pituitary hormone that comes and drives the ovaries. If it doesn't get enough estrogen, it'll scream at the ovaries. But it'll be high one day, and then a person will have a period the next day. And so it's really pretty fruitless to check the FSH.
Is that, again, somewhat of a mimic of puberty, where periods can be very irregular and checking of hormone levels might be, you got to be very cautious about that?
Right. In the first 2 years, basically, after the initial onset of menses and puberty, we consider irregular periods normal. Mm-hmm. It's the exact same thing at the end of time when you have menses. That in it's all really about ovulation. That as the ovaries are starting to work at the beginning of puberty, that sometimes you're going to ovulate, sometimes you're not. The same thing happens at the end. As the follicular pool has decreased, sometimes the brain is going to drive ovulation, sometimes it's not. And so you're going to get those irregularly lengthed cycles.
Follicular pool being the eggs.
Being the eggs.
In the ovary. Okay.
The eggs have decreased. I was trying to say it in a sensitive fashion.
Ursula is all about what is the follicular pool? What is my working material here?
All right. I just want to make sure we're on the same planet here.
You know what? A significant difference there, though, is that in a young girl, an irregular period is virtually never a cancerous process. Whereas when you get women who are, know, 40s, 50s, 60s, and you start having irregular bleeding, while the vast majority of that may simply be hormonally driven, our ears prick up really quickly, and we're far more likely to do endometrial biopsies to make sure there isn't some pathologic process going on there, or ultrasounds, a combination.
So the message there is irregular bleeding as you approach menopause may have other causes other than natural menopause, and you got to be careful.
Right. When I'm grilling women about how irregular and what kind of patterns they're complaining about, I find skipping long stretches to be reassuring, or having periods that are sometimes very light, unexpectedly light. Whereas if the woman is having more frequent periods and more episodes of heavier bleeding or bleeding in between the cycles a lot, that's more concerning.
Yeah. It's more indicative that there's something else going on in the uterus that may be causing the bleeding to progressively get worse.
Correct.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. Although, you know, we gynecologists do probably the majority of our endometrial biopsies around that perimenopausal stage, whereas, and still find some cancers, but probably the majority of the cancers we'll find will be in women who are quite a bit older. If it's been years since they had any menstrual cycles and now they're bleeding, that's a real big red flag.
Let me remind listeners again, over the next 45 minutes, 50 minutes or so, you can reach us with questions about the menopause at 550-8433. That's our local number here in Anchorage. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Tina, I'm not sure I've heard you say yet, or I missed it, why women go into the menopause specifically. What happens to cause that to start?
Well, it's probably a simple age-related loss of ovarian function.
It's the follicular pool.
It's the follicular pool.
It's the follicular pool.
Oh, that again.
Yeah. That's a great description now.
Okay. Because we're born with, well, let me see, when we're conceived, or infants, fetuses have something like 2 million follicles, and then by birth it's something down to
500,000.
And by the time you get to be menopause, you're down to a little dribble drab, right?
Right, exactly. So every time that women are going through menstrual cycles from truly the onset of birth, really, but menstrual cycles specifically, you're using up eggs. And it's not, while we do ovulate only one egg per month, you actually are going through many more eggs than that each time. And so you're born with a certain amount, and basically menopause is the depletion of all those eggs. I think, you know, we talked a little bit about estrogen, because that I think is the most hormone that's focused on as a loss of at menopause. But in terms of ovaries, ovaries continue to produce additional hormones at menopause. And so I think that there's a big difference between women who go through natural menopause versus surgical menopause, where their ovaries are removed. Ovaries also produce androgens like testosterone, and that can be actually a very important hormone that continues to be produced following menopause. And so women kind of almost go through, I think, a two-phase of menopause. You know, initially they get the things like hot flashes and other symptoms, but then later as menopause progresses, they lose that androgen production as well, which then you start, I think, noticing a decrease in sex drive, things like that.
Although it's, you know, that's always confused me a little bit, because there are conditions where women have either ovarian tumors that'll produce androgens, or, for instance, with polycystic ovary syndrome, and they have more androgens. But those women don't necessarily report more libido. Have there been any studies on that?
No, but the level of androgens is so low, even in women with polycystic ovaries. It's still a relative amount. Mm-hmm. But if you look at women who have surgical menopause and you just replace estrogen, you many times don't correct all of the things that are associated with menopause. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because we haven't found the ideal way to replace the other hormones that ovaries give. And those are the two big differences that I see.
Although, you know, I have to say, I'm kind of a believer that libido isn't necessarily just related to ovarian hormones, that it may be related to brain neurotransmitters or who knows what else. Because there are women who will have even their ovaries removed and their libido exited left stage, you know, 5 years ago or 5 years later. So I'm not sure it's even crisply related to ovarian function. It's so...
No, it's very gray.
So frustrating.
I'll bet there's more than one gene involved.
Ooh, there you go. Multigenic.
All right, we have a phone call. Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I just was wondering, how long is it safe to stay on Primpro? I've been experiencing really serious hot flashes for like 5 years, but I've been on Primpro for about a year and a half, which has made a major difference.
All right, let's define Primpro or whatever that was first there.
Primpro. Dr. Thompson will know what it is.
Oh, yeah. Primpro is one of our old workhorse hormone replacement therapies. In a woman who has a uterus, we know from the olden days that we don't want to use estrogen only if we can avoid it. Estrogen only tends to increase abnormal growth within the uterine lining. So we use a combination of an estrogen and a progestin product. Primpro is Premarin, which is a conjugated equine estrogen. It comes from pregnant mare urine, Premarin, and medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is a progestin, a synthetic progesterone. And that combination controls the uterine lining so you don't have an increase in uterine cancer while you're getting the estrogen to relieve hot flashes and night sweats, those kinds of things. And there isn't, it'd be actually pretty handy if you know, when you're when your pills became dangerous for you, they, you know, they turned purple or, you know, or bells went off or something like that. It's always a kind of a sliding scale, like with anything else. We know that estrogens are, there's just nothing like estrogens for controlling hot flashes and night sweats when women have those. As well, vaginal estrogen is fabulous for vaginal dryness after menopause. But we know now, finally, from the Women's Health Initiative studies, kind of a better mix of what the risks and benefits are. It appears that that women do not have fewer heart attacks when they're taking estrogen. We used to believe that. Their risk, the most significant increased risk in women on estrogens or combination HRT is the increased risk of thrombi. The women using hormones as compared to women not using them have more clots in their legs, lungs, and strokes. Even in the Women's Health Initiative study, which was many thousands of women that went on for years and years, and they're still actually getting data from that study, they didn't kill more women with clots, but they had more events that required hospitalization, anticoagulation, those kinds of things. There was also a slight increase in breast cancer in the women on Prempro. So what you have to do is make an individual judgment based on the age of the patient, how miserable they are, you know, what their risks are for thrombi and breast cancer, and kind of what their personal risk-benefit ratio is. And it's a very individual choice these days, knowing all these different things.
Okay.
Did that answer your question, Mary?
Well, pretty much what another doctor told me, which is kind of like it's a coin toss.
Well, yeah, I guess the thing I always like to point out, and Tina and Ursula, if you want to change my mind, I think it's always a risk-benefit ratio. You've always got to think about what's the risk of not doing a treatment, no matter what that treatment is, and the risk of doing it. And so that's why it does get down to very individualized decisions often instead of national guidelines. Each person's got some different reasons to maybe want to do things.
Let me simplify what my own personal code has become since we've come out with the WHI information. Generally speaking, if a woman doesn't have any strong contraindications to using hormone replacement therapy and their symptoms are bad enough, generally speaking, they're just not getting enough night's sleep, then I think it's fine. And there are some studies underway, and they're trying to figure out whether using hormones as a woman slides through menopause and using them for a few years may actually benefit her with respect to cardiovascular health. But generally speaking, up to about 60, barring any contraindications, I basically just mention, you know, that there are some risks and that kind of thing. Beyond 60, I figure that I need to document that conversation on a regular basis, you know, and any updates on new information. And after a woman is probably 65, then I feel like I need to start getting almost shrill about, is this really, you know, is this risk-benefit ratio really good for you, and do you insist on continuing your hormones, that kind of thing. So that's my crude guidelines.
Well, I appreciate that because, I mean, I'm only 53, but, I mean, it's made a major difference, and when I wasn't taking it, it was just seriously miserable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So often I know in asthma management, for example, getting somebody, if they really follow through and they're compliant, adherent to the plans, they do extremely well. The hard part's to decide when can you back off again. It sounds like it's the same kind of issue here. Is there guidelines about when you back off or how you back off?
There are actually a little bit of kind of like recommendations, I think soft guidelines that you know, just like Tina said, it's a little bit based on age, a little bit based on, you know, how long patients have been on them, but that you try them for several years, and that the recommendations, I believe, are after, you know, 3 to 4 years that you're going to try to wean them by 5 years, because that increased risk in breast cancer was shown after 5 years of hormone replacement therapy. So if you're trying to not get that increased benefit, I mean, increased risk, then you're going to try to wean them before that. Mm-hmm. And that actually the breast cancer risk then was nullified by stopping the hormone replacement therapy after 5 years. So patients no longer, if they'd had hormone replacement therapy for 4 years, then several years after that, their breast cancer risk was the same as the general population. And then if they don't tolerate that either wean or stopping of the HRT is when then you come back to having documented conversations.
Okay.
Well, another comment, too, is that I really feel clinically that the Premarin products do a very, very good job at controlling menopausal symptoms. They're just practically unbeatable. But there also have been some studies lately that transdermal estrogen products, that is specifically hormone replacement products, may have lower risks of thrombi. So if we were to redo the Women's Health Initiative study using transdermal estrogens, there might be a different mix of risk and benefit ratios. But we don't have that kind of a study at this point. Mary, when you as you go forward, another transition you might want to make is to try, if you really need to continue use them, is to try to slide over to a topical transdermal product.
Thank you. I really appreciate the information.
Okay, Mary. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. And we have another Mary calling. Welcome to line one.
Hi. I am going through menopause right now. I'm 51 years old, and I have decided not to go with the hormone replacement treatment. I guess what I'm understanding from you is that the purpose for that is to relieve the symptoms, the hot flashes and the night sweats and the mood swings and all that. Is that right?
Yes. Hot flashes, night sweats, vaginal dryness, yes.
Okay. Well, I warn my husband when I'm having a mood swing, so I've got that covered. And I just really right now I'm doing the hot sweats, or the night sweats and hot flashes, and they are pretty pretty strong at times. It's a little embarrassing during a meeting on occasion. But I think I would rather just live with that than do any of the hormone stuff, as long as I'm not missing anything and I'm not...
Yeah. Yeah, so your question is, do you need to take hormonal replacement therapy?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely not. You know, and I think, you know, I appreciate actually the Women's Health Initiative study coming out, because there developed really a kind of a popular culture around using hormones. And I think it gives people a more balanced approach to whether they really need them and whether they need them for what. And, you know, you really have to kind of weigh for yourself. It can be difficult to get through some of those hot flashes. You know, I certainly recommend turning the thermostat way down.
I have multiple fans as well.
Oh, fans, thermostats, you know, loose clothing. If, you know, I mean, all kinds of things. No more turtlenecks. No hot beverages before you go to bed at night. Don't drink wine or have any alcoholic beverages in the evening. All those things can increase your hot flashes and stuff at night. They've done some studies on biofeedback that helps hot flashes and that kind of thing during the day. Acupuncture and acupressure have been studied a little bit. I'm not sure of any results there. Soy has had, some people have talked about soy giving them some relief. I think in some controlled studies, it hasn't been too impressive how much soy has given women relief. Black cohosh, which is a herbal remedy, Simisifuga racemosa. I actually saw one of those in a neighbor's yard one day. I said, "Hey, that's black cohosh," but that probably helps many women reduce their hot flashes by maybe 50%, and the severity maybe by 50%. So you have fewer bad ones, and so black cohosh products are being used quite a lot. SSRI antidepressants. Effexor was probably the first one that was studied. Then there's also, golly, then we start getting kind of exotic after that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I highly recommend hypothermia.
But you don't have to do anything. It's again, it's an individual choice, how much it's bothering you, but there's no
Correct.
Really bad consequences, right, necessarily.
Well, interestingly, the recommendations are now that hormone replacement therapy is used for the symptomatic treatment of menopause. Okay. So if your symptomatic treatment, if you have symptoms to the level that's driving you to a physician, that's going to be the first thing that mm-hmm. the physician mm-hmm. recommends. But if they aren't driving you to that, it's mm-hmm. fine to go through kind of natural menopause without, you know, hormones or replacement, and that usually they will resolve, you know, within 1 to 2 years, sometimes less than that, sometimes 6 months. And that's going to be kind of the same process even for those women who do hormone replacement therapy. When they discontinue it, they're going to still go through that same kind of wean of hot flashes. So at some point, it's most likely going to happen.
Yeah. You know, and one of the other things that's been happening with the Women's Health Initiative study is we heard some early reports on it back in 2002 and then I think in 2004, but they have continued to follow the women who were in the WHI for other issues. And as it turns out, if you decide not to use any hormones, those of us who don't, it's not that women using hormones will be smarter, have less Alzheimer's, you know, better bones or anything else. In fact, there was a recent report that came out said that we should not look to using hormone replacement therapy to reduce dementia or bone fractures or heart disease and those kinds of things. People can't go to the mall and say, oh, look at her, she's not on hormones. You know, oh my gosh, what was she thinking?
Yeah. Well, that's helpful. I really feel better about that because I wasn't sure. And, you know, at night I have a very thick terry cloth towel I live with. And during the day I try and schedule my meetings accordingly.
Yep. And, you know, and I found that I went to looser necks on the clothing that I wear and a scarf. If I need to, I wind it on, I wind it off. It's like, I don't know, it's like the Karate Kid or something.
I've got a question that I wrote down here, and I can't remember why, but it must have been something I read. It says, are hot flashes related to sleep? And I don't know why I put that in there. Does that mean anything to anybody? I mean, although I know they happen during sleep.
Hot flashes occur less during REM sleep. And so you're going to most likely get them during the first 4 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be a sleep disturbance. Yeah. And as you hit the second 4 hours of sleep, if you're getting 8 hours of sleep in this ideal world, then that's going to be less. So while I don't think hot flashes are, you know, related to sleep disturbance, you know, if you're going to have them, they're going to wake you up. And it's the first 4 hours of sleep. So I think that, you know, keeping your room cold and doing, you know, less blankets, throwing double blankets on the partner, 60 degrees. I know Dr. Thompson keeps her house very cold.
I think my poor book group
is very cold.
My poor book group would rather sit out in the snow than be inside.
So what's driving the hot flashes? I'm assuming it's hormonal changes, but then maybe that's not right.
Well, there's some kind of vascular instability, but probably what we've got to do is we've got to flash freeze some woman having a hot flash and dice her up to get it all figured out. So it's really hard to study.
That's not ethical, is it?
No, it is way not ethical.
Yeah, even the mice?
I'm not sure.
The mice have hot flashes, yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. In fact, there was something I came across that talked about do other animals have hot flashes?
Right,
and I guess there are some other mammals, particularly... you know, are probably reasonably distant relatives, but chimpanzees and other kinds of creatures that have some menopause, but it's not clear that they have hot flashes. So,
well, I'll tell you what, we're almost halfway through. I'm going to take the time right now to go to our break. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection in Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to take calls and emails as we talk with Dr. Tina Thompson and Ursula Balthazar. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Tina Thompson and Dr. Ursula Balthazar of the Anchorage Women's Clinic. We're talking about menopause. We can't quite seem to get away from menopause. We're talking about it so much. Over a brief break, we were talking about it quite a bit.
The baby boom generation is doing it, so we better talk about it.
Let me remind our listeners, then, you can reach us at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember also, if you're listening between 7 and 8, it's a recorded broadcast, and you'll have to go to alaskapublic.org at any time and listen to the program again, but we won't be able to take any questions or answers to your during after the program is over. Here's an email that came in I would like to read and ask you to respond to. Is I'm a 59-year-old woman who had a hysterectomy 15 years ago, and that included removal of the ovaries. Following that, she took estrogen for 13 years and then stopped taking it 2 years ago. Almost immediately, she began to have hot flashes. So three questions she asked. Are hot flashes worse after stopping hormone replacement therapy? How much longer can she expect to experience hot flashes? And are there any other developments? We've kind of talked about this, about the prevention of hot flashes that doesn't involve, and we've kind of addressed that already. But how do you want to answer at least the first two questions?
Probably 70 to 85% of women will have hot flashes. 15% of women have none at all. But of those 85%, let's say, of women who do have hot flashes, about 15% will never quit having them. So we don't know why there are some women who quit having their hot flashes and other women who don't. She may be one of those 15%. When a woman, if she's going to have hot flashes, then she's going to notice them when she stops her hormones because they will be masking them. But having been on hormones doesn't make those hot flashes worse than if she hadn't been using hormones for those years.
So it's not the estrogen you're taking that's driving the hot flashes.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And when women ask about how can they stop their hormones, should they taper off of them or should they stop cold turkey? Generally speaking, if you go down the road 3 months from whether they stop or taper to when they're completely off, it makes no difference. The same number of women will come back, put their hands around your throat and say, give me back another prescription, I'm miserable, whether they taper off or whether they stop cold turkey. But it's, so there isn't any, so it's probably a more of an individual characteristic than anything exogenous like from her hormones.
Do women who have ovarectomies prior to 40 have hot flashes?
Yes. I think, you know,
anytime you remove the ovaries, you're at risk of hot flashes.
Absolutely. And I think that actually women who have them before 40, in my experience, have more severe hot flashes. Because if you look at the natural rate of, you know, estrogen and hormones is that, you know, even though in a normal ovulatory cycle, peak estrogen levels are going to be the same regardless of if you're 35 or if you're 45. But hormones, women are meant to be ovulating again until the average age of menopause, which we talked about, is 50. And that perimenopause starts at 45. But before that, it is abnormal to have menopause. So it's abnormal to not have estrogen before then. So really, women prior to 40, whether it's by surgical means through removal of ovaries or if it is by natural and, you know, early menopause, we recommend them have hormone replacement. So in a very different fashion that when you're going through natural menopause at 50, that hormone replacement is more optional. If you're going through premature menopause, hormone replacement becomes less optional, and I generally recommend it to patients until the time of natural menopause.
Okay. Linda, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to call in and say that I count my blessings that I only have 1 week of menopausal symptoms at all. I probably stopped having my period when I was about 52. I'm 62 now. I'm very fortunate that I don't have the symptoms that all my friends have, and I'm just wondering how unusual this is.
You're probably in that 15% of lucky women who don't really have any symptoms, and I would keep it quiet, or people will beat you to beat you with their purse.
You said 50%?
No, 15.
Well, 15%. Okay. Yeah. Well, I always have called myself an alien, and early on, I was telling my friends that, you know, I'm just not gonna go there. I'm not gonna have the symptoms, and you know, it never happened. So. I feel very lucky.
You know, even how menopause treats you may be familial. In general, if you ask your mother and aunts and other women in your family how menopause treated them, if they were miserable, you may be miserable, and vice versa. I remember reading a book by Margaret Mead's daughter. Margaret Mead, no. But anyway, the story goes that Margaret Mead was in Papua New Guinea or something and asked women, you know, how is your menopause going? And they were like, What? When our period stopped, so what about it, you know? So there were no complaints. Even when she got specific and asked them leading questions, they had no particular complaints.
Well, I think I come from a mixed bag family. Some had severe menopause and others, my mother never did at all. So I guess I just followed in her footsteps.
You know, I'm always fascinated by this connection with temperature, too, because I'm not sure that we have to keep our houses at 72 degrees. There's some kind of an artificial construct.
Obviously, you know what we know about it.
61 degrees.
But for instance, my...
so cold. Kooks in every profession.
But you know, if you think about your grandparents, they didn't have central heating, you know, and the bedroom was always cold. And
wait a minute. These gals were in Papua New Guinea now.
Oh, yeah. They were sweating all the time. They had no idea.
Well, we always kept our house fairly cool, so maybe there's some logic there.
Yeah, very good.
All right. All right, thanks.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks for your comments. Well, there's some other issues around menopause that may be important to talk about, and one I can think about is osteoporosis. So where's the connection there? What about hormone replacement therapy and osteoporosis?
Man, the drum that I would like to beat about osteoporosis is think about it when you're 16.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, if everybody my age turned to somebody younger and made them get exercise, calcium, and vitamin D, when they hit menopause, they would have such a nice storage bank of bone that they wouldn't really have to worry about it as much. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you can find yourself behind when the first you think about it is when you hit menopause. But what we do know is that, of course, osteoporotic fractures increase with age, and we do start losing bone at around the age of menopause more significantly. But the most important predictor is how much we've built of our bones. Mm-hmm. And if we've avoided some of the medication and other issues that'll lead to severe osteoporosis, like premature ovarian failure and premature menopause. So that's why Ursula was recommending that women who go through an early menopause or lose their ovaries early use hormones up to about 50, so they'll have that stability of estrogen helps, just like vitamin D, get that calcium into your bones and makes it more possible.
And that's what, you know, in terms of recommendations and guidelines, when women see you, even just for their annual exam around the time of menopause, if they're not having symptoms, and we're talking about symptoms like the hot flashes, then we don't recommend hormone replacement. So hormone replacement is not recommended to prevent osteoporosis. However, it does prevent osteoporosis. So for those women who are on it, they are gaining that benefit, but we no longer use it to treat it because of, again, of that risk benefit ratio. So in terms of, because you are at increased risk for the thromboembolic events as well as for breast cancer, we can't recommend to treat or prevent osteoporosis for that reason, which is why, though, if menopause occurs before 50, we do recommend it because you're still in that not necessarily active bone building, but not kind of a natural bone depletion that happens.
Mm-hmm. Although, if a woman has some bone loss, I've never seen a woman build bone, regardless of hormones or anything else, unless she's also getting exercise. I think exercise is probably the most powerful component of building good bone and keeping it. So that's a big... another issue is actually balance, because what we want is for people to not have spinal compression fractures but not land on their hip. And balance is a big deal. Exercising and things like Tai Chi, yoga can help people keep off of their hips, basically.
And calcium and vitamin D, especially here in Alaska. I don't think that there's really a female in Alaska, regardless of age, that probably should not be on vitamin D replacement.
Yeah, absolutely.
The way I understand it, and I just kind of want to focus on this so that people can understand what you said earlier, Tina, is that the important time for preparing for menopause or for osteoporosis later in life is in the preteen years, really.
Yeah.
And that's as you're developing bone, you're storing calcium. Mm-hmm. And if you have less calcium in your diet than you need, you're going to start taking calcium out of your bones over time. Mm-hmm. And that exacerbates at the menopause. And so if you're not prepared early in life, it's tough to win that battle later.
Well, interestingly, you're actually building bone until the age of 30.
Okay.
So right. I think that's an important thing.
So exercise, vitamin D, and calcium are all part of it. Mm-hmm. And this gets back to the sedentary lifestyle that Western society is. And also, obesity affects vitamin D levels, among other things. In fact, we're not going outside. Even if you live in Guatemala, you can have vitamin D deficiency because we spend too much time indoors. Anyway, so the point is, it's not the time to think about your osteoporosis at 45 and 50. It needs to be getting the point across to both women and girls, or women girls Absolutely. And boys, yeah. early in life.
One of our nurse practitioners at Anchorage Women's Clinic, Heidi Herleman, likens it to starting an IRA. You know, or your retirement plan. Start early.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Put a lot of bone away when you're young.
Here's an email. It says, I'm a 51-year-old woman, found that diet and exercise greatly affected my menopausal symptoms, getting daily exercise and eating a diet rich in vegetables, fruits, and low-fat protein made a huge difference. I stayed away from sugar and simple carbs. Comments?
I don't have any data on that. I'm not sure I've seen any studies about diet on menopausal symptoms. But it sounds intriguing.
I think when you talk about menopausal symptoms, we focus so much on hot flashes because that's almost the most debilitating. But there's a lot of other symptoms that we associate with that, increased rates of depression, anxiety, insomnia. But even in women who you replace estrogen and decrease hot flashes, they still have increased rates of those. So for people who are making lifestyle changes around menopause, they're going to have an improved, or a decreased rate of kind of those other menopausal symptoms that they may not be necessarily menopausal at all and just may be midlife symptoms that both men and women go through. So, being more active, I think, is going to help people at every age.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With respect to that, one of the fears as we get older is that our brains will go and our memory goes and that kind of stuff. In the hormone studies, they have not seen any brain preservation and cognitive skills, a decrease in dementia or anything like that with using hormones, although studies with exercise have shown it to be a benefit.
Right.
So if you exercise and think and use your brain and take classes and that kind of stuff, then your brain preservation is better and less dementia. And I'm a big believer that if you get plenty of exercise and you sleep deeper longer, you'll maybe you'll get through a few of those little hot flushes and that kind of thing. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Most of the evidence gets to a lot of these things is exercise, healthy living, and good nutrition. I mean, it's you know, we all like to think that there's some magic formula, and there's lots of people who want to sell us their magic formulas, but there's not much evidence to support much of this other stuff that we hear about.
Right. And I think that's the thing with hormone replacement therapy, why, you know, the big committees, and you've heard all of this in the news has come out about how, you know, it's controversial. And it's really controversial because women should be on it for symptomatic relief, because it is not a panacea medicine. It's not going to make everything that happens around that transitional time of life go away. It's really, truly beneficial for kind of what we've stressed, you know, in terms of symptoms, but it's not going to make those other things go away. And healthy lifestyle changes are going to be, you know, much more efficacious to make those go away.
Mm-hmm. We haven't brought up the word cancer other than endometrial cancer, Tina, that you mentioned earlier. What about breast cancer? There's been concerns in the past about increasing risk of breast cancer or related to hormonal therapy or prevention now. Where does all this stand?
We probably got a lot of good information from the Women's Health Initiative study, but there has been more since. Generally speaking, breast cancer increases with age. On the other hand, some of the more vicious breast cancers can happen to younger women. And as we get older, if we develop breast cancer at an older age, it's often a little more indolent and runs a little more indolent course. So. But what happens with using hormone replacement therapy is that, and then this is as compared to women who don't, everything else being equal. When women in the WHI used PremPro, we saw approximately a 15% increase in the incidence of breast cancer. Subsequent studies since then have also suggested that they were more node-positive breast cancers, and a little more likely to die from those breast cancers.
So maybe more aggressive is what you're saying.
Right.
Okay.
And those numbers, though, are not big. Apparently, the numbers of deaths increased from something like 1.8 to 2.6 or, mm-hmm. you know, 1.6 to 2.6 or something like that. So out of 10,000 women. Mm-hmm. So the numbers were not very dramatic. On a very interesting thing was that in the estrogen-only arm of the Women's Health Initiative study, these are women who'd had a hysterectomy, so they only used Premarin. Those women in that category, we didn't actually see an increase in breast cancer rates. And that's been confirmed looking back at the studies. On the other hand, after the initial report from the WHI, a couple things happened. Number one, the people who'd produce Provera, the medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is the pro part of PremPro, put a black box warning on their product that said, we might be contributing to breast cancer. So we've started looking a little more carefully at hormones not being just estrogen, but also the progestin, and that it may be contributing to the increase in breast cancer, not just the estrogen. But the other thing is that a lot of women stopped their hormones, and then the rates of breast cancer diagnosis dropped. So on the backside of the studies, we saw a decrease in breast cancer diagnosis rates, even in women who stopped using their hormones, including just the Premarin. So the numbers are pretty small, and it can be hard to parse these things. But it does appear that hormones of both kinds, although probably the combination hormone replacement therapy was a little bit more of a culprit than the Premarin only.
I wanted to ask about heart disease, but let me get this email that came in also. So this lady is asking, what are the risks of hormone replacement therapy? We've kind of talked about that a little bit. How do you feel about bioidentical hormones? Could you discuss bioidentical hormones? And does menopause impact sleeping?
Bioidentical hormones are, you know, I think this makes me understand why I like science. I never wanted to do like science fair projects when I was a kid or anything, but I really like studies. I like double-blind, placebo-controlled, prospective, randomized studies and that kind of stuff. And I wish there was more data about bioidentical hormones. In general, I think they're probably efficacious. If you take something and you come in and you say my hot flash has improved, I believe you. And it may be because it has some estrogenic effect. There's debate as to whether, for instance, black cohosh has some estrogenic effect or not, or whether soy does. But I can't tell you dose for dose what dose of bioidentical hormones is equivalent to a Premarin 0.65. And one of the things that bothers me is that is the presumption that since it hasn't been studied, it must be safe. You know, even the black cohosh, if we use it, it seems to be safe, but how much do we really know?
Not much.
Not much.
That's one of the problems. Yeah.
So I'd love some studies. You know, I'd love to see some studies that would give me an idea of, you know, is this bioidentical progesterone as endometrial protective as the progestins that I like to see for hormone replacement therapy or not? How can I trust it? What's the risk of thrombi? What's the risk of a breast cancer with bioidenticals? We should presume probably that if they're as efficacious, they're probably as dangerous.
About heart disease.
Well, heart disease was a big part of the Women's Health Initiative. And I think kind of, you know, besides getting long-term data on the risks of estrogen replacement, on the potential benefits as well. And there had been some studies that came out before the Women's Health Initiative that had talked about that estrogen was beneficial and was cardioprotective. And so there was this question of should women be on hormone replacement because it's not only cardioprotective but also relieves symptoms. And what the Women's Health Initiative really fleshed out was that it was not cardioprotective, and that it did not offer actually any cardiovascular benefits. And as a result, I think that's where hormone replacement made a turn to just being a symptomatic treatment as opposed to kind of a necessary component of, you know, the menopausal transition, because it doesn't benefit the heart. And there actually was some slight increased risk. I mean, you know, if you have an increased risk of thromboembolic events, you know, of blood clots and things like that, you're going to have an increased, you know, or potential detriment to cardiovascular health. So they're trying to flesh that out, I think, a little bit more, because that was a very surprising. That was probably the most surprising part of the Women's Health Initiative, was that the lack of benefit to cardiovascular health.
And yet, on the other hand, the argument against the WHI being very conclusive in that area was that it was designed so that they took women who didn't need HRT for symptomatic relief, and they were studying them. So a majority of the women in the study were 60 and older. So I think it was like 70% mm-hmm. of the women were over 60 in the WHI study. So they've gone back subsequently and then said, well, but what if we took a woman just transitioning through menopause and kept her on hormones? Would it then be cardioprotective? And that's really the question that's they're trying to answer now. Is there some preventive benefit in say, everybody using hormones up until, you know, 55 or 60 or something like that? I'm sorry, sometimes I try to go to the conspiracy theorist side of life and try that on, and sometimes I think it's the makers of hormone replacement therapy, especially YF making Premarin and Prempro, their market share tanked after that WHI report. You know, everybody was flushing their hormones down the toilet or throwing them out. And I think some of those studies may have been their response to, hang on, we've got to find a market again, we've got to drum up a new market. So let's look at let's find a hole in the WHI and see if we can plug it. So, but it may very well be that they'll recommend that most of us use hormones for a few years after menopause for cardioprotective benefit. But leaving ovaries in does seem to be cardioprotective in some method.
But that's because of the androgens. No, I'm just kidding.
what we're talking about here is if a woman has a hysterectomy, say she has a fibroids, and you take out her uterus, do you leave the ovaries in? And recent studies have suggested that maybe there's a benefit compared to her twin sister, for example. If you leave the ovaries in up until about the age of 60, you're weighing leaving the ovaries in and taking a risk of ovarian cancer as compared to maybe having some cardioprotective benefit. And there may be some cardioprotective benefit in leaving the ovaries in for a while. But as we get older, all this preventive stuff loses strength.
I think one thing that we haven't talked about that, you know, Tina and I had talked about at the break to address besides osteoporosis was the benefits or kind of the effects of menopause on vaginal side effects. And that, you know, there's so much focus, again, because I think of the impact of hot flashes around the time of menopause is that's the biggest symptomatic menopausal feature. But, you know, again, as women even get further from menopause, they can develop vaginal side effects like vaginal atrophy, increased risk of, you know, urogenital infections because of the changes of the epithelium that occur when the loss of estrogen occurs. And so that you can actually use a topical estrogen that doesn't have the same systemic absorption. So you're only focused on treating that area. And I think that that's something that, you know, going to your physician and saying, okay, well, I don't have these other side effects. Should I be prophylaxing against this? And I'm actually a pretty big advocate for that because I think there's a lot of side effects that women kind of ignore and then develop. And it's kind of hard to fix over time.
I think what Ursula's alluding to is basically the impact on sex life, and when the vagina loses estrogen, it's very estrogen sensitive, and with atrophy, it thins and becomes less distensible, so that women will sometimes report that they've got burning, irritation. Sometimes it feels almost like tearing. And then, you know, if intercourse becomes that miserable, then pretty soon they're running in the wrong direction. Talk about an effect on your libido. The libido we talked about a little bit ago doesn't correlate exactly with menopause, but having an unpleasant sex life can impact that. And then there's also sometimes a slowing in the sexual response cycle and some of those things. So. Those are things that are also kind of a natural part of losing estrogen.
We've talked about a lot here, and we've got about 2 minutes left. I sometimes like to sum up well, and what I'd like to ask you guys to do is, what do we want women to hear about menopause and this hormone replacement idea?
I guess what I'd like to... I actually, one of the things I really believe in pretty strongly is that around the age of 50, women are going through a big transition in a lot of areas. You know, it may be closing in on retirement, empty nest. What are we going to do next? Have we saved enough for retirement? All kinds of other things. There are a lot of stressors. And when women have emotional issues at around the age of menopause, it may not simply be the hormones. Please be open to the idea that some of the other stressors may be playing a role. Another thing would be that hormone replacement therapy doesn't make us leap tall buildings. that it can be great for symptom relief, but it's not the be-all and end-all that it was held out to be for a while there.
I think also there's just a lot of misconceptions that hormone replacement is something that should be avoided, that it's dangerous, and that it has been created to help women make that transition through a sometimes truly debilitating, hot flashes that then, you know, bring on insomnia, and that it is really meant to help bridge that time period, and that, you know, people should be very open and have a conversation with your physician about using them.
So yeah, it's there's no requirement to treat. There is an available treatment that's relatively safe for those women who have symptoms that are significant enough for them individually to want to do something about it. And the best way to answer that question is to talk to someone who has very good experience about how to address those particular issues, sometimes with medication, sometimes maybe not. And that everything that happens during that age is not related to hormones. I heard you.
Not necessarily, right?
All right. All right. Well, thanks very much. This has been a very fast hour. I think it's been very educational. I really appreciate the time you guys took to join us today.
Great. Thanks, Ed.
So my thanks to our guests, Dr. Tina Thompson and Ursula Balthazar of the Anchorage Women's Clinic here in Anchorage. Let me remind everybody, if you'd like to continue conversations like this, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find these links at our website, alaskapublic.org. And also there are several other links at that website regarding the program today. Next, why don't you join us next Monday afternoon when we'll be discussing some local efforts to help treat and prevent obesity. My guest will be Carol Fink of the state of Alaska. Cindy Norquist, who is involved with the Healthy Futures Program, and a family practitioner, Katie Butler, who will tell us about the WOLF program, Working on Lifetime Fitness, and the We Can program, Ways to Enhance Children's Activity and Nutrition. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday, June 18th from 2 to 3 p.m. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor. Thanks for listening.
Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.